Matthias, let's just take a second to talk about our Patreon channel. Obviously, a lot of people love the show, and we get a lot of messages from people asking us how to support us and help us grow the podcast. Now, Patreon is obviously, without doubt, the best way to do it. It really helps us grow the show, helps us pay people who help us out, helps us, you know, keep shining the job, the editor behind the scenes. Why do you want to just let people know what they get, some of the perks?
Yeah, I mean, we offer so many interesting extra things for patrons. I mean, we have a bonus episode, we do Q&As, and we're also looking into other ways of like getting our Patreon supporters special access to some of my very deep, fantastic knowledge and such things.
Yeah, you're wanting to introduce some, not one-on-one, but small group lectures on specific subjects, which I think would be amazing. Patrons would absolutely love that. I would absolutely love that. You know, half an hour topic of you just ranting without me interrupting on a subject has to be perfect. You know, who's not going to love that?
Yeah, like things, you know, we talk about on the podcast, maybe like we mentioned something about Viking ships or something that has to do with the mythology, and people want to know more about that. And then we can like dig deep into that for like 30 minutes in a short lecture. I think a lot of people would find that very interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, let's not forget, anybody who signs up to the Patreon at any level is going to get a bonus episode every week. It's either going to be the story time episode that we do with Jonas Lorentzen, which you have to agree with, Hayes, is one of the funniest times you must have all week. It is brilliant. He does
such amazing.
A good job.
I love it.
It is. And then the other episode, we're still undecided 100% on what it's going to be, but it looks like it's going to be a conversational type episode where me and Matthias just get a little bit more personal about ourselves, but also we're going to let people have the chance to ask questions, Q&A, whether it's about the podcast or about us. You're going to be able to put your question to us through Patreon. And then we're going to have a little bonus episode where we explore those and people get a little bit more interactive with those, which I think would be fun for the fans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I feel like I'm seeing with our audience is that they really like to be interactive with us. So we're trying to offer as many opportunities on our platform to do that outside of social media. Otherwise, because that can get a little much sometimes.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, honestly, if you just jump over to Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, you can have a look at all the different tiers we've got there. They start from $5 up to $20, and you can cancel at any point. You can try it out for a month, listen to the old episodes, listen to the old storytime episodes, cancel it if you don't enjoy it, and there we go. But we're more than sure confident that you'll like what you hear. Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farron, co-owner of the company Hornsvoldin, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvik.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today, we're joined by Andy Lewis, who is the CEO of Norse Fitness and also the owner of Norse Compound, and works a lot with mental health and those kinds of things in context of Norse stuff. So welcome to the show, Andy.
What's up, guys?
Don't forget to shout out his podcast as well. Andy, get that in there right away.
Yeah, so I'm CEO of Norse Fitness. We also have a gym called the Norse Compound in North Carolina. And as of the past year, we also have a podcast called The Norse Mentality. You can find it on everything, I guess. Yeah.
So, yeah, go and if you like this episode, definitely subscribe to that and give it a listen. So, yeah, I mean, I noticed when I said, checked out your podcast for the first time, you know, you seem to be a big advocate of I don't know, I was trying to figure out how to say this earlier. It's because it's not an advocate for mental health, but it's an advocate against fighting mental health, I guess. I'm not sure how you say it.
I guess that's the best way to put it. Yeah, for sure. We definitely talk about that a lot. And I guess the reason for it is because it's something that I've always struggled with my entire life. Whenever I was 7 years old, I was suicidal and I had to go start seeing a counselor and shit. And I really didn't, I was just throughout my entire life, I've been just trying to find different ways to cope and in order to deal with it. And I would say around 10, 11 years older. So I realized that exercise made me feel better. So I would just run and run. And then any physical activity was just kind of a release. And then in high school, I started playing in a band and I did all that stuff. And then, you know, we toured and stuff till I was about 25. And then the band broke up. And honestly, I was just an absolute wreck. The bottom of the barrel, just as low as it can get, alcoholic pretty much, just really a degenerate in all reality. And I was like, all right, well, if I continue down this path, I'm not going to last. So I started working out. And when I started working out, you know, you need motivation and stuff like that. And to me, it was just, you know, I always looked at the sagas and Norse mythology and stuff that I grew up listening to and reading. And I used that as motivation. And then that slowly turned into Norse fitness. And now it's this whole umbrella thing, like corporation, whatever the hell you want to call it, movement, ideology, all different things.
First of all, I'm pretty sure you said seven.
Yeah, I was seven, man. I remember walking into my dad's bedroom. It was about, I don't know, we'll say it was nighttime. I remember walking in there and I was just like, I want to kill myself. And of course he was like, what the hell? And I mean, like, I was always a really quiet kid growing up and didn't really talk about anything at all. I just kept to myself. And yeah, just one day I went in there and told him, and, you know, immediately, of course, he was concerned. So he started getting me help. And I don't really know, no, really the counselor thing didn't really help at that time. But luckily he, you know, he did different things as far as just getting me to talk and getting things off my mind. And I think that's what it's always boiled down to, is self-talk and just the shit going on in my head and everything else. And then at the time I didn't know to detach from it. So, that lasted up until, like I said, I was about 25. And then whenever I kind of switched gears and stopped drinking and just started trying to live a more positive lifestyle, that's when it really started to change. But I mean, even say last year, I had a pretty, as far as like mental breakdowns go, I mean, I spent like 6 months having one pretty much every day. And it was just, and then it was really after that, once I got through that and I developed all these different tools and stuff, that's whenever we started the Norse Mentality podcast. I was like, all right, well, I got through this. I know that other people are dealing with it. So let me just throw out what worked for me, my ideas on it and everything else. And hopefully that can help other people as well. And so far it seems to be, you know, beneficial to those people that are listening to it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's such an important thing to talk about, especially at the minute. There is an epidemic of mental health, I think, on the rise. So that's why I wanted to do this conversation, and particularly against people for people who are into this kind of community, you know, tend to be maybe males who work out and they've got that kind of quote unquote warrior mentality. I don't know whether that's the right term, but they tend to hide and shy away from mental health. It's not something you talk about. And that seems to be changing, I think, a little bit in recent years, but it's still, I think, quite demonized amongst men, and it's certainly you just shove it down and don't talk about your feelings.
That's something we talk about pretty much on every episode of Norse Mentality, is, and just with Norse in general, say, you know, I send out emails 3 times a week. We do daily social media posts and all that stuff, and everything's pretty much centered around that. And something we talk about all the time is, you know, learning to love yourself. And that's something that men don't talk about learning, but it's like, it's one of the first stanzas in the Have Them All. And it's like, how does that just go? But then even in this whole Viking community or Norse community, whatever you want to call it, that stanza is completely left out. I've never seen anyone talk about it.
No.
Yeah. I mean, people are very selective when they read that stuff. Right. And so many, they you know, idealize this like badass warrior that's out there solving all their problems with violence, right?
Well, your first problem, like, if you can't deal with yourself and you can't work on yourself and you can't do anything to the exterior world, like, you have to get yourself under control, and you need to find your own strengths and find your own weaknesses, and then learn how to eliminate those weaknesses as much as possible. Not saying they're always going to go away, especially when it comes to depression and mental health in general, because there could be chemical imbalances and all this other shit that's out of your control, but there's a lot of things that you can do to combat that. But even, you know, another thing we talk about is, like, men don't want to talk about their feelings. men definitely don't want to go to counseling. Men, but as far as I'm concerned, you should do whatever you need to do in order to be the best version of yourself. And if that means going to counseling, then go to counseling. If that means talking to your bro, talk to your bro. Like, that is the whole tribe mentality anyways, that you have a group of friends that you can rely on. And that goes back thousands of years. That's what we've always been doing. But now we just keep it all bundled up and we don't express ourselves. So the more that we keep it inside and we just push it down, eventually that shit erupts and you end up having mental breakdowns. And some people kill themselves, or, you know, they result to drinking and drugs and all this other stuff. And yeah, like, it's just whatever you need to do in order to level up as an individual, you need to do that, not only for yourself, but for your family, for your friends, for your community, everything. It all starts with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I think also something to take into consideration is that in many ways, a lot of these problems come down to the lonely man. And the lonely man he's a real person, first of all, but secondly, he's also like a culturally generated individual nowadays, who has basically come out of the industrialized working class. Right? So when we get industrialization and we get a lot of, in case of Europe and then also subsequently North America, we get in industrialized societies, and then we have all these migrant workers, people who leave their original communities, so to speak, to go to the cities to work. And this happens in Germany as one of the first places, England, France as well. And then later on, it becomes simply like a way of life. And that's what, you know, much of American society actually is, you know, this moving around from place to place, trying to find a job. It's not uncommon for somebody to move from the East Coast to the West Coast, you know, in a country that's basically the size of a continent compared to Europe. And this is very, as somebody who comes from Europe, it's very different, right? Because my people, we live in a country of 5 million people with pretty much the size of Vermont, with a little bit of attachment of like Rhode Island or something like that. Very small country, right? And you see people who take issues with having to move across that little spot of land to find a job or something like that. They're like, no, I'm going to stay with my original community, right? And so, but those general big encompassing processes, right? They create lonely human beings in general, right? And that's where I think we see a lot of mental issues. Like you were just saying, Dan, we've seen this spike with the isolation that people have been feeling. And I mean, I've seen several reports too on how, you know, domestic violence is up. And those kinds of things, that divorces as well, right? It tells us that isolation. Yeah,
I know a bunch of people that got divorced. As soon as the first lockdown hit, about 3 months in, I think at least four couples that got divorced. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the stresses of spending more time together, or, you know, just being locked up. I don't know what it is, but it was a sharp spike, and you could see it kind of happening across the board, which was, you know, it's a sad situation.
Mm-hmm. People finding out that they can't hang with each other for that much, for that long.
Well, that's what I said. I said to one of my friends who actually did go through it, and say, you know, you've got children, you both work, you work long hours, so you're up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're doing bitch, getting ready for work, you take the kids to school. You go to work, you come home late, maybe like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, you go to bed. So you're never really spending much time together. And maybe you've drifted apart over the years, but you just haven't realized yet until you're thrust in this unprecedented situation where you now have to spend every minute together for 3 months and realize, you know, maybe we have just, you know, we're not the same people. And it's quite sad that we live these hectic, busy lifestyles and don't get to enjoy the things we love.
I think part of that as well is that people were forced to actually be real with themselves. You know, before the pandemic, it was go, 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 work. You know, you had a habit, you had a schedule, and it's very easy to not focus on yourself or your thoughts and all this stuff whenever you're always busy. And what COVID did was it forced people to stop and actually reflect and be like, I'm not happy. Well, what am I not happy about? Could have been a relationship, could have been job. I know a lot of people that just end up moving jobs. Like they quit their other one and they started something else. And they were still employed during the pandemic, but because they had more time to themselves at home, working from home, whatever, they were actually like, I'm not happy. I want something better for myself. So I think that's part of it too, is people were forced to slow down and have that talk with themselves that they've been avoiding for 3 to 5, 10 years, whatever it may have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it feels as though there's been a huge disconnect to people taking kind of ownership of their own actions and their own lives. I don't know what it is or when it happened, but so much seems to be pushed outwards, especially you see arguments online, and it's all kind of out. But people don't hold themselves accountable, or it seems that way. A lot of people don't hold themselves accountable for things, and they're quick to blame other people or something else, or you know, it's somebody else's job fault that they didn't get a job, or something else, or somebody else's problem that something didn't go quite right. It's never my fault, and people don't like looking internally, even though sometimes that's where the answer is, I think.
Well, it goes back to victim mentality, or it starts with victim mentality, and that's something that is embraced in our culture nowadays. You know, people have this place that they can go, you know, online, Facebook, social media, all that good stuff, and they can go on there and they can play the victim and they get likes and they get attention and all this stuff, and it becomes an addiction to continue feeding into that. And that's not necessarily something that has ever been culturally embraced before. Having the victim mentality a couple hundred years ago, even for say 100 years ago, they would have told you to get your shit together. Like, no, you know, you control your life, you control your actions, you control your thoughts and your emotions and all this stuff. But now it's, oh no, you can get a pity party very easily just by typing out a couple words and posting it on Facebook or Instagram. And because of that, now we have an entire civilization that embraces the victim mentality instead of being like, fuck, this is the reason why I'm not progressing in life, is because I refuse to take responsibility for my actions and all this other things.
How do you see that play out in sort of like broad cultural terms? Like where do we see sort of examples of this kind of pity party that you're talking about?
Even when it comes to a relationship, you know, they can, I know I see women all the time and men, of course, but they both get on there and they kind of passive aggressively complain about their relationships. And then, you know, the opposite sex will slide into the inbox and be like, oh, poor you. And then they get attention that way. And I mean, it's across the board with just about everything that you can make an excuse, or finances, wealth. You know, if you want to make money, especially in the 21st century, you can make money. It's going to take learning and it's going to take work and it's going to take taking responsibility and everything else. But you can also just be like, oh, poor me. I need to start a GoFundMe to pay for my bills this month. And you get, and certain people get gratification from those kind of actions. And it just becomes a habit. It becomes part of their personality, is to play that victim mentality instead of, you know, eliminating it and just taking responsibility for your life.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody's suggesting we go back to maybe like how you said 100 years ago, where you would just be told to pick up your bootstraps, you know, and get on with it and get over it, because that's not the answer either. The answer lies somewhere in the middle, because, you know, sometimes people do need a little bit of help. They do need guidance and direction, but also you do have to take responsibility for yourself. I know firsthand when it comes to weight loss. There've been times where I've tried to look for excuses why I can't lose weight. And I'm like, maybe I've got an overactive thyroid. Maybe I've got this, maybe I've got that. You know, trying to find some excuse as to why I'm not losing weight or why I'm not the way I am. And the reality is, when you really look at what you eat or how much you do, that's where it lies. And and that's for 99% of people, that is the issue. It's you're eating too much. And it sounds really shitty. And there will be people listening to this and like, well, they'll probably like, I'm not. And I'm like, but if you really break it down, you probably are. Because I know when I broke it down, and I went on like a strict 9-week diet and counted the calories, did the macros, did everything. It made me sit back and look at what I was doing before. I was like, fuck, even though I thought I was being good and being healthy, it wasn't. I was wrong. So you know, sometimes it takes like that to happen for you to really kind of go, you know what, maybe I wasn't right.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like when it comes to perceiving food, like in a fitness context, we are, as human beings, we're so bad at actually dialing into to like what is in the stuff that I'm eating, and we're so good at also just coming up with excuses that like you're talking about. I mean, for fuck's sake, I've been losing weight lately, but before I was doing that, I was gaining a decent amount of weight. And one of the reasons for that is that I'm an immigrant, and I finally can afford to have Coca-Cola in my fridge all the time. So at some point I was like, hey, I need to just like dial that back and stop drinking Coke every day.
Mm-hmm. But that's right? That's the other thing with the whole pandemic as well. You're at home all the time. Your fridge is there. You can go and get something. I know, even though I wasn't in lockdown because I run my own business, I have my own workshop. There was no, I went to work every day through the pandemic because there was nothing to stop me. But I still put on weight. So it was just this excuse. It's like the world's fucking gone to shit. I'm going to order a takeaway. I'm going to eat bad. So, you know, I did that. And I'm lucky enough that I've never struggled with mental health. And I feel very blessed that I've been kind of in that position. And I still was like, yeah, I'm going to eat what I want. Because maybe I feel a little bit sad, so I'm going to eat something. So, you can imagine why that will play into the hand of the rise of mental health as well. Because if you're not feeling good about your body and you're looking at yourself and you're a little bit overweight, you soon get in your own head and feel shit. You feel shit.
I think it's also a matter of comfort. Like human beings, it's in our DNA to try to find comfort any way possible. And nowadays, everything is comfortable. Everything is easy. So you kind of have to take a step back and be like, okay, is eating this large pizza actually my best interest, or is there a part of me that's just trying to make myself feel better? Is there a part of me that's trying to get a dopamine release because everything's been shut down for a year and I'm depressed and I just want to eat all this delicious food because it's going to get a dopamine response and it's going to make me feel better because I'm just unhappy right now, you know, instead of maybe taking a step back, okay, well, I shouldn't eat this large pizza because it's going to make me feel worse in the long run. You know, what is something I can do? Get outside, get some sunlight on me, meditate, go for a run, go to push-ups, like anything possible. If you don't necessarily have to fall into those temptations, which I mean, I do too, of course, like everyone does, but you're fighting against yourself with all that stuff because like I said, it's in our DNA to seek out comfort. That's why we live in this glorious world that we live in now with all this technology, is because human beings have done everything possible to make their life easier. And now it is so easy, but it can work against you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've often said that like eating well is the easiest thing in the world, but it's also the fucking hardest thing. It's both things, because everybody knows how to eat well. Anybody says they don't know how to eat well, like you do, you eat natural food. Everybody knows what vegetables are. Everyone knows like what natural meat is, not that's not processed.
I have to disagree with you there.
You do.
Not everybody does. Definitely no. Not everybody, especially not in American society.
No, they do.
I have students at my work who very obviously don't even know how to microwave shit.
But no, but that
like they have not been taught though. Basic food skills.
That's different.
So,
yeah,
so that is something that we actually have to keep in mind. Some people have not been taught basic food skills in this modern world. Actually problematic.
I understand that, but they still, I'm sure they still know what a healthy diet would be, or at least they know what vegetables are, what salad is, what just meat is. You just need to eat or like naturally grown things, and you're gonna eat at least a healthy diet. But
your faith
also
in humanity is greater than mine.
maybe but I think maybe not everybody, the majority of people at least know what a healthy diet is, but I fall foul to it. It's fucking hard to do, because when you smell a pizza, or in England you smell fish and chips driving down the road, I'm like fucking what cartoon was it, like, was it Looney Tunes where he gets picked up by the nose and like dragged into the shop? That's what I'm like all the time with things. I'm driving past, and if that smell comes into my truck, I'm stopping. I'm like, fuck, I want that. And I'll have a sneaky little bit to eat whilst I'm driving for no reason other than the fact I smell it. And I'm like, yeah, that's good.
But you justify it to yourself. You always find a way to just, I just call it the 5 second rule. So you, most people, unless you just like are completely unaware, which I mean, there are people out there like that. They're just raised in a different household that were just, they just ate fast food nonstop. They don't know anything different. But the majority of people can look at something and their first response is, I shouldn't eat that. But then within 5 seconds, your brain goes, yeah, but
oh yeah,
you've been stressed out lately. You've been a little sad. You worked out earlier. So that, you know, you have 5 seconds not to justify it to yourself. And then after that 5 seconds, you're pretty much screwed because every single part of you is going to somehow make logical sense in order to do it.
That is one that I've done. I've worked out today. I did extra in the gym. So I've earned this. And it's like, no, you haven't. But I know people who will wake up in the middle, they'll eat half a bar of chocolate or whatever, and then they'll leave it in the cupboard. And they'll wake up in the middle of the night, like, fuck that chocolate's in the cupboard, and go down and get it. So it is a real thing that, you know, when you know something's there,
I'll eat half a bar of chocolate and leave it in the cupboard and then, you know, come back to it like several days later because
you got some willpower.
So Andy, how do you find inspiration in Old Norse literature to for instance curb such eating habits and, you know, gain the willpower to go to the gym and, you know, fix your mental health and all those things? Like,
if you look at everything in Norse mythology, there's a lesson to it, as you guys are already aware of. But there's also an embodiment figure to it. So say if you want to be on pursuit of wisdom, obviously you embody Odin. Like, and if you respect this individual and this idea of that person or God, or whatever you want to call it, you're going to be less tempted to mess up because you're not only doing it for yourself, but you're also doing it for this other figure, right? And you're trying to embody this person. And then there's a little voice in your head that goes, is this something that Odin would do? Is this something that Thor would do? Would Thor skip a workout? When you start thinking like that, it's extra motivation because you're embodying this person. You're not embodying the you that would skip the gym. You're someone different now. You're someone more powerful. You're following the footsteps of someone that you're aware of someone that you look up to and that you respect. And that right there is extra motivation. And you can apply that to everything. But, you know, like Odin and Thor are two examples of it. But even like outside of the gods, you know, read any of the old sagas, like the Icelandic sagas and stuff like that. There's motivation all throughout there. It gets you fired up, or at least it does for me. And that's why I do everything that I do. But when it comes to, say, mental health or physical health or any of that stuff, I think it's just a matter of looking into the past. Like, we've become so disconnected from our primitive roots that's one of the reasons why we are depressed. And that's one of the reasons why we don't eat the right foods and all this other stuff, is because we are disconnected from the real world in all reality. Like, we're disconnected from the real world. We live in this little man-made artificial world where it's just comfort and shitty foods and distractions and all these other things that are actually working against us and not for us.
Well, I mean, nowadays we also have, you know, an entire non-physical universe that we can escape into, like, as you were pointing out, social media before, yeah. Right? But for what I'm seeing in the younger generations, or also the gaming communities, right? That's a way for you to sit down for a very long time and not move your body around, and then be lost in a world where you can,
and it's incredibly fun as well.
It's incredibly fun, but it also supplants things that, you know, we would have to come by through more natural means in the past, such things as a social life, like a community, right? Because you can sit there, you can chat with your friends, and you can, you know, become really good friends with people in those gaming spaces,
you can make a really good podcast with someone you've never met as well,
for instance. it's not that this is just bad. There are positive and negative things to them, but what you find, right, is that all of a sudden you have a community of people who are global, but very few of them, if any, are local, right? Mm-hmm. And so that means that you're not going outside with friends to go somewhere and hang out or you know, workout or, you know, go hiking or whatever the fuck you want to do with your friends. You're sitting and gaming instead. And that's where you find your friends. And that's where you get that dopamine rush that is attached to the social life, right?
You brought up the younger generations, and I don't really know a lot about the younger generations, honestly. You know, if you're younger than 25, I don't really know what the hell is going on in your world. But from what I can see, they're extremely socially awkward because they're growing up in this alternate universe, like you said. You know, all their interactions is through text and through online messengers. And then when they have to actually talk to someone face to face, they can't look them in the eyes. They, you know, they're looking at the feet, they're stumbling on their words. There's no confidence there. And that's detrimental on its own, because there's a big difference between social interaction in person and social interaction over the computer, or even this right here. You know, if we were all three sitting face to face right now, like, this is a great conversation, but it would be a lot more impactful if we were sitting in the same room together. Like, there's this, you know, you pick up on each other's energies and body language, energy, all these different things, but we're neglecting that now. Once again, it's not rocket science. It's just stuff that we're getting further and further away from. That is in reality, the real world. It's stuff that we've been doing for thousands and thousands of years. And when you just kind of start going back in that direction and mixing it with this modern world, a lot of your problems start to get solved.
Mm-hmm. No, that's, I think in many ways you're right about that. We could take some very solid lessons from the past, and especially now, because when I bring up the younger generation, it's not because I want to do that thing of like shitting on the younger generation. No. I think it's our, as the older generations, it's our responsibility to give the younger generation some input on this stuff. And
We were the younger generation once, and
exactly
everyone shit on us.
Yeah, those definitely shit on us, because I mean, I'm happy to say when I was young, I was a fucking moron. I'm not that far from being a moron now, but I was especially a moron. The stuff I thought when I was a kid, like, I would, it's just fucking ridiculous.
But no, that's okay. So there's a couple of things there, right? So the younger generation, yeah, sure, always needs to be guided, right? Because as a kid, you're a moron. That's like a universal truth. That's also why I never listened to a 20-year-old. Listen to a 30-something and plus-year-old instead. When you're in that younger age, what you need to do is to of course learn basic things and skills and so on, right? But that's the problem, right? If we then have a society where all of a sudden we have alternatives to learning how to socially interact on a normal person-to-person level, right? Then that's when things start to fall apart, right? And I think we're seeing some of that, and I think it's getting worse with virtual reality meta universe that Zuckerberg has created.
That's gonna be wild. But I think the important thing as well is just, it's such a cliche, but everything in moderation, and that's around the board. That's not just for gaming or eating. Even for people who are obsessed with the gym, there is people on that level who go so far the other way and it becomes unhealthy. You know, you see people see Instagram models and they're like, I want to look like that, but you don't see the behind the scenes. You don't see the days of dehydration, the fact that they're on death's door when those pictures are taken for a lot of the photo shoots, because they've stripped all the water from the body to look like that. And it's not healthy. It's not good for your body, but people just see that image and go, fuck, they must walk around looking like that. And it's like, no, they don't. So, you know, it's all directions that people take things to the extreme. You just have to try and find the right balance for you. And it's not easy. It's not easy at all. It's incredibly difficult. And like you were saying earlier, Andy, people who tend to suffer with mental health, it's a lifelong struggle. There doesn't seem it's not an overnight fix. I'm a proponent for going to the gym, working out, eating well, because I've seen that work for Sarah, my wife. I've seen that work for her, and that's helped her with her mental health. So I'm a big advocate of that. I think people should try that route, but it doesn't go away. It just kind of helps put it down for a little bit, but it still rears its ugly head again, whether it's in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it's still kind of always there simmering. So that's why you need to try and keep on top of it and keep yourself in a good state of mind.
I think it's a matter of having daily habits that address mm-hmm. different issues of your life. So, you know, physical, obviously going to the gym. Well, that's not necessarily mental. You do get that dopamine release and all that stuff after working out, and you might feel confident and good, but it slowly goes back downhill and it's not necessarily mental. So like a mental habit that you could do every day is meditation, or even journaling, or going on a walk, you know, just to clear your head, getting out into nature, stuff like that. And if you can implement different things throughout your day that will help with mental and physical health, over time, they just become habits. This is just something that you do. It becomes part of your identity. And whenever you do that, the depression and the anger and all these other things that people deal with, they slowly start become less and less, because you are developing into a different person over time. And like with myself and depression became a habit almost. Not entirely. And I know that might like sound weird to people, but it was the only state that I knew. And then when I just got tired of it one day, and I was like, I am going to do everything in my capability to eliminate this and to become a different person, to be a positive person, because I used to be extremely negative and all these other things. Like you said, it didn't happen overnight, but I continued to just change my identity. I no longer associated with that person anymore. And then over time, I didn't, but it still takes every day. Like I have a morning routine that I have to do. It involves meditation, it involves reading, it involves stacking victories, because that's what makes me feel good. When I start stacking victories, say if I wake up when that alarm goes off at 5 a.m. Okay, cool. That's victory number one. I do some breath work and meditation. That's victory number two. I read for 20 minutes. That's victory number three. At that point, you're building momentum for the rest of the day. Then when you lay your head down on the pillow at night, you feel fulfilled. And that's something too that people don't have nowadays. You know, 1,000 years ago, everyone had a certain task. And if you didn't do that task, your whole tribe suffered. So it wasn't really even an option. But now people, they don't necessarily have purposes anymore. And if you don't have a purpose as a human being, you feel lost. And that's something that I hear a lot from people is, what am I supposed to, like, I don't feel like I'm doing anything with my life. And that is a terrible feeling as a human being, because we always feel like we need to be contributing to society in some sort of way that is beneficial for like humanity, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think that has been lost and people need that just, like you say, just doing things for other people and needing and feeling that gratification as part of a community. And doing your,
it's that tribe mentality.
Doing your pit, doing your bit, doing your role. I know Sebastian Younger, Tribe, is a brilliant book for that. He talks about how in disadvantaged communities, you don't tend to see this much of a problem, because there is still that community there where you have to help each other out. And even though they have less, you have to hustle, you have to help your neighbor, and you can rely on your neighbor to help you if you need, and you look after each other. Whereas in maybe better off communities, you just don't have that. Everybody has their own little house and they stay in the house and they go to work wherever, and you don't speak to your neighbor, you don't have that community, and it's just started to disappear, and it's extremely sad. I mean, I don't particularly talk to my neighbors. I know them to wave and say hello, but I wouldn't feel comfortable going and asking for something or needing a favor. You just do naturally kind of keep yourself to yourself, unfortunately.
There is no way to feel bad necessarily when you help other people. So say like anytime I've just been in a complete rut, in a completely shitty mood, something that I know that I've added to my arsenal over the time is just helping someone. It can be a complete stranger. Like if I see a homeless person, I'm just like, you know what, here, like if they need money, or if it's someone at my gym, I just go up to them and start talking, and I find out that maybe they're dealing with something. So then I can help them with their issues if they need it. When you help other people, that is the most powerful tool in order to make you feel better in general, because you're no longer focused on you and all these other things. You're contributing to society again. That's that tribe mentality. That's what we've been doing forever. It goes back to, you know, we've become disconnected from our primitive roots. And that's one of the issues that we have nowadays with depression and anger and all these other things. So like if you're feeling just really down, just try to help someone else. And I can guarantee you it will make you feel a little bit better at least.
And conversely, right? If you take your random anger out on somebody out there in the world, right?
That makes you feel even worse.
It makes you feel even worse. And it's probably also going to make your problems worse in general, because you know, you never know what's gonna happen in that situation, right?
Yeah, like, you might get your ass beat real quick. I mean,
right. You might, yeah. There's always somebody with a bigger dick, eh, Mateus?
That's my motto. There's somebody out there with a bigger dick. But that's the thing, right? I mean, that, like, we're across the U.S., we're seeing, you know, violence on the rise. We're seeing murders on the rise. Like, just you know, random shootings in traffic are, like, rampant in a place like Denver, which, you know, is a, for America, a pretty small, you know, metropolis, I would say. And so, like, that, and if there's anything that's, like, an indicator of, like, the kind of anger that people harbor in themselves, and it's, like, you know, road rage, if you ask me. Like, this is where, you know, interactions between human beings are so impersonalized, because it's a human being who's doing something over there, but you can't see the human being. You can just see this metal box that they're sitting in, right? And so that makes it even easier for you to get really pissed off, right? And then, you know, there's the whole element of, like, actual danger, because, you know, you can get killed, you can get physically harmed in so many ways, right? So that, you know, makes you even more aggressive. And then there's the fact that you constantly have something flickering in your side, around you and behind you as well, right? Which, you know, also just, like, you know, signals danger to the eye. So there's so many aspects of driving in traffic that can get you really pumped up and aggressive. And so if you're seeing more and more people taking out their aggressions in those contexts, I think it's a good indicator of just how fucked up people are feeling right now. Yeah,
for sure. I agree.
Well, I think sometimes it comes down to just compassion as well, because yeah. You don't know what somebody else is going through. And this is something I think I've got much better at as I've got older. When I was younger, I was very pig-headed and kind of, I wouldn't say uncompassionate, but I just didn't think about things like maybe that person who's kind of, maybe they've just kicked off, but maybe they've just lost their parent. Maybe they've just lost a son or a daughter. Maybe something really terrible has happened to them and they're having a really shitty day. And they might lash out, but it's not going to make it any better. You make that situation worse. Because you don't, like I say, we don't know what other people are going through and what's going on in their life. And sometimes you need to just maybe take a second to think, because I've been in a situation where I want to get angry and I'm pissed off and I'm like, fuck, you can't do that to me. But then you got to take a second to think, well, is it going to make the situation better as a whole, or is it going to make it better me just kind of biting my tongue and walking away and everyone at least gets to go home in one piece, I guess.
Everyone's dealing with their own shit. Every single person on this planet is dealing with something or the other. But a lot of times we're so focused on our eternal world and what we're dealing with that we don't do what you just said and actually, like, put ourselves in their shoes. But okay, well, maybe their parents just died, or maybe them and their spouse just got divorced, or maybe they're just having a really shitty day because mm-hmm. just small things like traffic or something small like that. So I definitely think, like, being empathetic is probably it's a learned thing. Cause I didn't give a shit about anyone, honestly. But the older I get, it's definitely like, okay, well, I understand that a lot of people are just dealing with shit, especially nowadays. So whenever someone loses their shit, it's like, just don't take it personal. They're probably just dealing with their own thing and they're going to feel shitty about it later, and just brush it off, you know, focus on what you can do to better your day.
The thing is, it's also the type of societies and networks that we as humans exist in, right? There's no immediate reason, I guess, for you to care about another person in the streets of some big city, right? You just walk past people. You're not expected to give a shit. And if you were to give a shit about every person, you'd be a weirdo. Well, you'd be a weirdo, but you'd also get exhausted, right? Like,
especially in a certain place like New York and New Jersey, and those places on the East Coast. If you were, like, walked up, someone's like, "You doing okay today?" They'd probably knock your ass out, like, especially like in Boston or some shit. Like, in certain parts, you're not allowed to give a shit about me.
Yeah,
don't worry about me. You know.
Yeah, and those are really problematic ways of interacting as humans in general, I would say.
It's very hostile.
It is very hostile, and humans are are prone to empathy and compassion biologically, that is part of our biological capacities. And so you can see that in kids, for instance, they tend to show these emotions towards one another. But they're also, their worlds are smaller, and they, you know, they don't have to deal with hundreds of people on a daily basis, right? In the same way. So that's a big difference. And that's something that, you know, comes from, you know, a situation where we just like, we've overpopulated the world in general.
Yeah.
Which means, of course, then that it takes an extra, an extra level of mental capacity, I guess, to dial yourself back into that and then be aware that you actually have to like relate to your human beings in a if nothing else, a measured empathetic way.
I think it might also be life experience. So the more that you experience as an individual, it allows you to relate more to a complete stranger, even, you know, or someone that you just met, because you've experienced stuff. So they, if you're just like a younger person and you haven't really dealt with anything as far as like struggles and shit like that go, how could you relate to someone? You don't even know what that life is like. But the more that you do experience, the more that you're able to build rapport and to get on the same level as these other people. So I definitely think it's just a matter of life experience and dealing with shit and struggles and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's just a complex situation. I mean, we're never going to fix it here by any stretch. But I think the more people have these conversations and people listening hear people having these conversations, then over then they're willing to maybe talk to somebody else and just spark up things, because like you say, we all bottle things up. And it's not, we've kind of focused earlier on just kind of men, because I guess we're men and this culture is definitely filled with kind of like that, like you say, that warrior idea of men. The community on it, I guess, it's probably male based. I think I would assume there's more men than women that are into this kind of stuff. I mean, from
who knows, man.
I guess if you look at like my Instagram kind of figures, it certainly would lead towards.
Oh, my, like, Norse is like 5%, 5% females and 95% males.
Yeah, I think with like Horns of Odin, it's maybe like 70% males. So it definitely seems to be kind of leading that way. And it is because it's like that cool warrior type thing. But that also leads into kind of this idea of, you know, shut up and don't talk about your problems, bury them, get on with life, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and keep going. And that kind of idea gets spread when sometimes you just need sometimes you just need a cuddle. Sometimes I just need a cuddle, and I don't mind admitting that. Sometimes I just want a fucking cuddle, and it feels better. Sometimes you just need to talk to someone, and them not to necessarily say anything, but just to listen. And then not necessarily, they might not have the answers, but just getting it off your chest and talking sometimes does help. And sometimes putting your phone down and going for a half an hour walk helps. It's a case of trying these different things and find out what works for you. But certainly the one thing that doesn't help is sitting there and being alone and putting it all back on yourself and kind of letting the depression fester within, and because that's never going to really help.
Well, I think an issue is people, or the idea behind what it means to be masculine or masculine energy or whatever, is completely ass backwards. So people don't talk about their feelings and they don't talk about what they're dealing with or whatever it may be. They keep it all to themselves because part of it is just ingrained in it, but also they're worried about what other people are going to think. Like a real man, he doesn't really give a fuck what other people think. You know, he's going to express himself, and if you don't like it, then get fucked. I don't really care. Like, my life continues on. I'm going to continue working towards my purpose. Mm-hmm. But over the, you know, I know, especially here in America growing up, it's like men don't talk about them feelings. And I live in the South. I always have. You just don't talk about it in the South. It's just not part of it. Like, that is the last thing a man does. A man doesn't even tell like his kids that he loves them, which I think is absolutely just fucked. But that's how bad it's gotten, is you don't even tell your kids that you love them, because that is expressing a fuzzy emotion, and that's not very manly. That's not very alpha. So our idea of what like alpha and masculine is nowadays is, in my opinion, it's just ass backwards.
Mm-hmm. But again, that can lead into this kind of tough warrior culture that you find within this kind
because like the idea of masculinity is like associated, you know, with violence in these contexts, right? I think we see that a lot in American society. Like, if you're masculine, then you're capable of violence, and that defines you.
It's a matter of balancing both. You need to be able to be violent because, I mean, that's the real world. Nature's violent. The universe is violent. You need to be able to be violent if needed. But you also need to know how to be compassionate, especially towards your tribe and your community and your family and everything else. Like, it's a matter of balancing the two. You don't have to be a violent hard ass all the time. But you need to be if needed. Like, if someone threatens you and your family, you need to be able to take their ass out. But otherwise, you don't have to. You can let loose a little bit. It's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay to just be you. Be like the authentic you. And if someone doesn't like that, then fuck them. It doesn't matter. They're irrelevant.
That's exactly, that brings me to the next thing I was going to say about that. And that is, to be a real adult man is to be responsible, right? Mm-hmm. That's if you ask me, if there's anything that defines masculinity, for me at least, it's to apply responsibility to who you are as a person in the world. And you know, if you just respond with violence, you're being a reckless idiot, right? And that is not being responsible. That is not being a man.
Well, say if you have a family, right, and someone, mm-hmm. you say you're about to get into an altercation over something stupid, which it's usually always over something stupid, especially if you're mm-hmm. at a bar or some silly shit like that. Mm-hmm. So say you're about to get into an altercation and you just let your pride and ego get the best of you and you end up getting killed that night, but you have a mm-hmm. whole family at home. And that could have mm-hmm. been avoided if you would have just turned around and walked away and be like, you know what, this isn't worth me getting into a fight over and all this other shit. Like, I'm just going to walk away. And if this other person thinks I'm a bitch, I don't really give a shit once again, because I know who I am. That's being responsible.
It's yep. ego, and your ego gets the better of you. And I think this is why I'm a big advocate for training martial arts, because before I started, when I was younger, I was a little hothead. I went to the gym all the time. You know, when I was in a bar drinking, I wanted to feel like the alpha. I wanted to, I was never one for really making trouble, but if like somebody did something wrong, I would be the first to kind of like jump in and say something, because it was that kind of, you wanted to be the masculine one. And that was that's such a wrong way to look at it now, but I was young and dumb. But then when I started to train MMA, you get a comfort about you where you don't worry about being in the situation. You realize you have nothing to prove. And more so that you can't go on looks on who's the quote unquote toughest one there either. Cause there's some little guys that fuck me up in jujitsu all the time. People who just you would look out on the street and think nothing of them, but they, you know, they're little killers. So you get humbled by these experiences. And then when you're out and about, you don't have to try and swing your dick about, because you feel comfortable and you know you can look after yourself in that moment. And I wish more people would kind of go down the route of trying martial arts, because it sometimes can maybe get a stigma for being violent, especially like MMA. People look at the UFC and go, oh, that's really violent. But if you can, you don't have to take, you know, you don't have to fight. You can just train it. And it, I think it just calms people. It calms you down. It certainly calmed me down. And I became a much more level-headed person because I just never had to worry about anything.
It also boils down to confidence. When mm-hmm. you train MMA and in any form of martial arts, or even if you're just lifting weights, the more confident you are, the less worried you become, especially in situations like that. You're able to remain calm compared to if you really don't know how to fight and you think that you have something to prove. You don't have anything to prove if you train all the time. It's like, it's just not worth it. But a lot of people lack confidence, especially nowadays, when it comes to fighting or just knowing who they are and knowing what they're capable of achieving. So they feel like they have to prove something because they haven't proved it to themselves yet in the form of learning and practicing.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think it's really important to build that confidence in yourself. And, you know, at martial arts is definitely a great way to do it. Also just generally building strength and muscles and that kind of stuff. I mean, I think my teenage years and early 20s is exactly how you described yours, Dan.
I think they all, mine were too. I think it's yeah. everybody yeah. for the most part.
But for a lot of kids, at least, you know, you and see, that's where you need that guidance though. You need, I would say you need an older male. I mean, my dad died when I was 17, so I didn't have that. But you need somebody who's like, look, kid, get your shit together and go chop some wood instead, or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. that's also part of it. Like going back to like feeling purpose, you know, being part of a working community of some kind, for instance, around a house or in some other context where you just do basic skills that, you know, I would say tend more toward the physical stuff than, you know, sitting around. Mm-hmm. That's also a great way to, you know, avoid getting into trouble, right?
Yeah, I agree. When you get yourself just so tired working on shit that you're just like, I don't have time to get into trouble.
Exactly right.
But also kids don't like fighting in general is discouraged. And I think to a certain extent, it should be, especially younger kids. Boys have always fought. I mean, there's so many sayings about that. It's because it's always what we've done. Like boys need to fight. And when you raise an entire generation of male kids and you tell them fighting is bad, violence is bad, all this other stuff, but they have this built up primal energy where all they want to do is wrestle and get that out. They don't have any other way to get it out. So then when they turn 18 to 20 and then their hormones and everything else is through the roof, and they've got this all these suppressed emotions that they really don't have any control of, because once again, it's primal. But that's the thing, especially here. I don't know how it is over in Europe, but in the United States, I remember when I was still in high school, if you even talked about getting into a fight with someone, they put you in handcuffs and took you to jail for talking about it. Like, what kind of shit is that compared to just letting them, you know, throw hands for a little bit? It's like, okay, cool. And shake hands. And then probably 2 weeks later, those dudes would have been like best bros.
Yeah, it's just, that's how it goes in Europe. That's how it goes in Europe.
That's how it used to go until you get stabbed now.
Yeah, yeah, that's another thing. No, I completely agree. Like, that's the way that this works here. I'm like baffled. I mean, you know, 15-year-olds in handcuffs and like, you know, locked legs and shit like that being hauled to jail.
Over like nothing, what? Really, man.
Over nothing. Nothing. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's fucking crazy.
So going back to suppressing emotions.
Yeah.
What do you think that does?
Exactly. And at the same time, it also brutalizes them because it basically tells them that they're on a path to become criminals. And the next thing that you know, they are criminals, right? Well,
they attach like themselves to that identity.
Exactly. That's very, very different. So, and it, you know, it's kind of interesting because I feel like here in the US you have to go to very specific places to get your ass kicked in a bar. You can easily avoid it if you go to quote unquote the right places.
Yeah.
In my home country in Denmark, you can get your ass kicked in any kind of bar, really. and that's because like fighting is not considered the same level of problematic as you see it in American culture. You still have a lot of people who sort of like have it in them in different ways. And especially if you're in a small town and you go hang out in the late hours at the bars, like you're very likely, if they don't know who you are and you don't know how to sweet talk them or something like that, you're very likely to end up in a fighting situation at like 4 o'clock in the morning, right? And so, you know, and that's because it's just part of the culture, you know, with in those communities, right? Which is,
definitely, I think, avoid fights. Don't go and get in fights.
We're not talking about anybody should get in fights. I'm talking about how these dynamics are working, right?
Yeah.
And that's because it is not taken as seriously over there. Is more considered sort of like, you know, in a small town, it's a regulating mechanism. It's like it's showing people where they belong, so to speak. So if you're the new guy in the place, then they'll have to show you that you're the new guy, right? Yeah. That kind of stuff, right?
I think with kids as well, like there's this idea that you're meant to, especially when it comes to education, they're meant to just sit there, be good, listen, be the perfect student. And if they don't, then there's something wrong. It's ADHD. It's something along those lines. When in reality, you know, sometimes little boys and little girls, they're just not made to learn that way. Everybody's different. And maybe sitting in a classroom reading a book isn't the best route for them. And obviously you have to do that because you have to learn basic things like English, math, science. You have to do that. But sometimes you maybe have to take a different route. It doesn't mean that they're bad. It doesn't mean that they're naughty. It doesn't mean that they're destined for failure or to become, you know, little fucks or whatever you want to, however you want to put it, or criminals. It just means they learn different and they need a little guidance, and they want to run around and play because that's how they feel more comfortable. And on the flip side, some kids like to sit and read because that's them. We're different. You can't just pull everyone into this little mold. And if they don't fit, go, oh, well, there's something wrong with you. Here, take these tablets. You're going to calm down. Because they just want to play, man. They just want to fucking run around. They're not bad kids. They just need some love and guidance and to get that energy out in a different way.
I think the schools nowadays aren't necessarily there to benefit the children. I think they're there to make obedient members of society. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, like having a rebellious strength is what allows you to take adventure and to take risks in life. And if you aren't willing to take risks, then you're not really going to experience life and you're not going to get ahead in it. But, you know, especially nowadays, by just making sure they're as obedient as possible. And if they're not, then they throw you on some medication to make you calm and obedient.
I think, you know what? I think it's not obedient. It's sedated.
Yeah.
Like there's like a difference here because, you know, you can have quote unquote obedient, well-functioning people in a society that also cultivates, you know, physical prowess in different ways. And just look at ancient Greece, right? Or go back to Scandinavian societies in the Viking Age, because you see that in the saga. Like they fight, they play ball, they do a lot of different things. Sometimes some people get really hurt, sometimes some die. But all of these elements are part of society, and it seems to function quite well. But what we have now is a modern culture that seeks to sedate people because it does not have other ways to handle what are otherwise natural responses to existing in the world. As you just said, like kids fight, and they should be allowed to fight to some extent, if you ask me. Yeah. They should have that freedom, because
I think sedation is the perfect word for it.
Absolutely.
Because
we as human beings, we need to express ourselves in the broad range of ways that we can and have always done, physically and biologically. And so if we take all that stuff away, then we end up with a really sad population. And I think we're seeing that.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Let's talk Warriors and Valhalla. And like I say, it all ties into this kind of topic, I think. Let's start with just a warrior. What we think a warrior is, maybe. I mean, traditionally, Matthias, I guess we can kind of say conclusively what a warrior is.
So in context of Vikings.
Yeah.
What we can see is that these Northern European societies from the year zero and onwards are developing towards more and more organized communities. And 500 AD is a good cutoff for when we have, I would say, centralized powers that can, in one way or other, conscript warriors. And before then, we're probably dealing with a higher level of freedom in terms of choosing to be somebody who goes to war and not, but also perhaps in many ways not, because you have tribal societies where you would probably be expected to fight to protect your tribe or clan. But at the same time, you also have mercenaries who go from Northern Europe to Rome and enlist in the army. So that's like an entirely different level of being a warrior. And those are the ones that you know, ultimately generate all of these awesome stories. Like, for instance, the story of Sigurd the Dragon Slayer. That's sort of like a derived narrative from the idea of being a warrior who goes out into the world, wins all the goals and all the babes, and then come back and you know, gets a kingdom as well. And of course, the Sigurd story is a tragic version of all of that. You know, he ultimately is killed and all that stuff. But we can expect that such narratives have existed and as oral stories that were told in the Northern European communities from the year zero and onwards, when they start, you know, enlisting in the Roman army. This is also why we see all those cool gold medals from the 400s and 500s, the Bracteates, that like have runes on them and some kind of like warrior with an Elvis hairdo, or sometimes it turns into a raven. And that's something that these you know, eminent warriors have worn, right? Like they, and this would be to show like, hey, I'm a badass. I am either a guy who has been down there fighting, or I descend from them. And I have a close relationship to the war god Odin. I'm pretty sure that that's how that worked out. Because those medallions, are, as I've told you plenty of times now, I think, they are copies of the medallions that the Roman legionnaires would be wearing on their armor. Mm-hmm. So it's like just direct sort of like cultural copying here. Okay, so that's like up until the 500s. So in the 500s, what we see is that there's a shift in societal organization in Scandinavia. You start having what you could call petty kings or chieftains, and they have a standing army. They have a hirth. This is a collective of warriors that live with the king, either right in his vicinity or maybe even in the same hall. You know, he's got like a nice little king's hall where he has these rituals to Odin. And this is where you have, you know, women serving mead and mead horns, and warriors are sitting along the benches on the side. There's a fire in the middle, and you have warrior feasts. And these feasts probably include some kind of ritual drama that has to do with Odin and that kind of stuff. And once in a while, you also sacrifice animals and this and that. And what then, you know, defines a warrior in that context is the interest in and will to become one of the hirth. And that, contrary to before, sets you apart from the rest of society. So before, right, it was only the ones who became mercenaries down there in Rome who were separate from society. The rest of those, what we could otherwise call warriors, were, you know, farmers who had to take up weapons once in a while for the purpose of self-defense, or, you know, occasionally probably also to invade a neighboring tribe and mm-hmm. and take their women and gold and that kind of stuff, because that's definitely something that happened. But you would see sort of like a mixed profession scenario before mm-hmm. the 500s. And then from the 500s and onwards, that's when you get professional armies mm-hmm. in Scandinavia. And it comes from that experience of mercenaries and warriorhood in army, really, right, in Rome. And so you have these little warlords or chieftains or petty kings, whatever we want to call them, who then have enough money, right? Because that's another part of it, have enough gold to maintain a standing army like that, a standing group of warriors. And this system expands and becomes more and more prevalent and encompassing. And that's, of course, because it's a very lucrative thing to be one of those warriors that sit there in the hall and then go out and fight on the bidding of this particular chieftain. And this is what generates the Viking Age in the 700s, because all of a sudden you have these families that over time you know, I think it's safe to say that dynasties in this type of society, they don't last much longer than five generations. But, you know, if you for five generations have accumulated wealth by being, you know, large landowner with a standing army that, you know, is making a lot of money off of trade that goes through the southern Scandinavian area into Russia on the eastern side and to Western Europe, to the Frankish lands and to England on the western side, then, you know, come the 700s, right? That's when you have enough warriors, enough gold, and enough ships to then take those ships and go raid at Lindisfarne, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in 793. There are indications of similar things happening before then, in the Viking Age properly starts around the 700s and not in the late 700s, but the beginning of the 700s. And so what you have is like this development where becoming a warrior in society becomes more and more connected with the idea of becoming a hero. And so that's what you can see in the skaldic poetry from the 800s and onwards. Skaldic poetry was invented as a distinct type of poetry to talk about being a badass warrior and a king. That's what it exists for. So you have a whole culture that is just like gaining more and more momentum around being a warrior. And that's also where you then get the idea of Valhöll or Valhalla. So the way that we know this from contemporary or from the leftover material from Snorri Sturluson in particular is, if you ask me, a very cartoonish version.
Just before you go on to Valhalla, mm-hmm. one question I had is, do you think that like every man of like fighting age in Scandinavia in the Viking Age would be expected to be a warrior? I would want to be a warrior. I would want to take the path. So I think that's probably like a misconception maybe that a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. If you think of Scandinavia in the Viking Age, it's just fucking full of warriors.
Bunch of warriors.
Everyone's a warrior. Every man who can pick up a fucking sword is out there fighting and taking what they want.
No, definitely not. Because, and there are different reasons depending on where we are in Scandinavia in this time period. Because in some places you don't have a sort of like a strict organized society with a very steep hierarchy. That could, for instance, be Iceland. And in other places you have that. You have a very steep hierarchy where people are locked into social roles, right? And it's almost like castes, right? So you, if you belong to the class of people who are supposed to just work the fields, that's where you belong, and that's it. And then there might be a lord who, in a very feudal sense, owns your land that you're farming on, who can then conscript you and say, look, you have to go to war now because I need a bunch of warriors. That's probably happening in from the 800s and onwards in places like Denmark and southern Sweden, southern Norway. But as soon as you get farther north and or more inland in Scandinavia or to Iceland for that matter, then you might see then you definitely see different differing social organizations where, you know, it's much freer whether or not you can choose to do that or whether or not you would be required to be a warrior to defend yourself and your land and your people and so on, right? So we have like these different tiers really of social organization in Scandinavia in this time period. But if we're in Denmark and you are a blacksmith or you are a farmer, then you're not a warrior by profession. And you probably have the possibility to enlist on a Viking ship and then build yourself up as a warrior. And that was probably something that some people dreamed of. That might have been sort of like just like people dream of becoming pop stars or whatever nowadays, right? That might have been something that could have been some part of sort of like the imagination of a little kid, right?
They might have dreamed of being pop stars too. You don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Skalds, they were pop stars, right? The Viking Age poets, they were definitely the pop stars of the
they
time.
They could have had a little Scandinavian idol set up.
Oh, absolutely. So, but it becomes more and more fixed who belongs to what classes, basically, in this time period. It becomes more and more stabilized, so to speak. And social mobility, I think, is very loose in the early Viking Age and gets more and more stagnant in the later Viking Age. So that's, you know, if anybody who's a scholar of the Viking Age will tell you that the Viking Age is the breaking point of Scandinavian culture in so many ways, because this is where you see so much, so many dynamic processes happening, and society changes completely, right? This is also the time period where Christianity is introduced. So, you know, in that sense, the Viking Age is the last part of a otherwise long-standing culture that goes back to the, you know, some couple of centuries before the year zero, right? And then it's the new beginning of a more modern culture in many ways, a Europeanized culture. This is the time period, the Viking Age, is when Scandinavians become Europeanized, right? In terms of like what is defined from Western Europe, in the centers in the Frankish lands and in Italy and so on. Before then, they're only like borrowing concepts here and there and getting interested in this and that and so on. In the Viking Age, that's when they fully become part of Europe as a community. So that's another process that's happening. And this, of course, also changes their ideas about what it means to be a warrior, what it means to be somebody who fights for a living and carries weapons and all that stuff. And this is also the time period when the laws start to change on that, mm-hmm. who can and cannot carry weapon. So
a warrior is a job,
basically. A warrior becomes
somebody who fights for a living, I guess.
A warrior in the Viking Age becomes a job. With this mercenary culture that then becomes a stable hirth culture, as it is called, right, where you have this group of warriors that are attached directly to a king or leader. And then after that, it becomes a situation of having aristocrats who have to go to war and will go to war, and they then conscripting a bunch of poorly trained peasants to as cannon fodder, right? That's what comes after the Viking Age, so to speak, or in the late Viking Age. So it's a process, right? It's a development like that. So going back to Snorri Sturluson, he gives us this description really of Odin with his Einherjar, yeah, in Valhöll. And this is definitely an idea that these members of the Hirth had. It's very likely that they thought that they were going to go to some kind of afterlife of that sort, where women would serve them alcohol, just like they do in the hall that their king has.
Chauvinistic pigs, eh?
Yeah, I guess. and it was also very likely that their idea of that afterlife was that it was defined by fighting. Like we would just fight for an eternity. Now, Snorri Sturluson gives us like a very cartoon watered down version of this. You can see indications of a much cooler sort of like even sort of a bit of horror influenced versions of this in other poetry. For instance, the poems that Simon mentioned when we talked with him, Eiriksmál and Hákonarmál and so on, they show a little bit more of like blood and gore, and you see this in other stories too, where it's just the expectation is more blood and gore than it's like, fun and games and nice beer hall, kind of like I'm at Oktoberfest in München kind of thing, you know. So Snorri gives us a sort of like a, if you ask me, a watered down version of what they really believed that they were going to go into. But one of the things that is really important to keep in mind is that as soon as you join the Hirth, in many ways, you also lose your identity. There's a great example of this that Terry Gunnell has pointed out, and that is in Jomsvikingar saga, saga of the Jomsvikings, which is this warrior collective that lives on in a castle somewhere in northern Germany. And I like these like Vikings that you can basically call on, like if you're some badass king. And they seem to come from many different places, actually, primarily from Scandinavia, but probably also from the rest of Europe, really. And they sit in that hall, and they've all taken on names that belong to legendary Viking heroes who are already dead. And that's the whole point. They're already dead. They're considered dead in their existence, right? Because they have entered warrior life. And so, you know, if you're already considered dead as you are alive, that of course means then that there's maybe not so problematic if you die, right? Mm-hmm. So that's part of like a shift and a change in mentality, and also shedding your previous identity to become a professional warrior. So that's what we're seeing in the literature in different ways. And you know, describing and explaining and conceptualizing warriorhood in possibly in pre-Christian society, because of course these are texts that are written down later on.
That's definitely interesting, because I think even in modern culture, in modern armies, you know, they strip away the identity to create this killing machine. So I guess it's kind of, it's interesting that they did that same kind of thing maybe back then, because you just assume that everyone was going around killing each other almost, when maybe it's not that natural to just go around and kill each other. You have to put some work in and some mental manipulation to get these people to just be warriors, be fighters.
Well, I mean, again, if we go back to this notion that we as human beings biologically have a tendency to be prone towards, you know, such things as empathy and compassion, which I think there's plenty of research on, by the way, that supports that. Then you, of course, have to come up with another mental space to be in, to you know, be a warrior whose job it is to kill, right? Because you leave what is peaceful society to enter a state of mind and existence that is not peaceful, that where you're always ready, right? And this is something when we look at contemporary army situations and people who have been to war, right? One of their biggest problems is coming back from war, right? That's where PTSD becomes a thing, right? And finding out how to live, you know, in contemporary, more or less peaceful society. I mean, I have a friend who's got an AR-15 next to his bed because of that shit, right? Like, that's how he sleeps always. And that's how these things work for some people, right? It can just be very difficult to leave that mindset again. And this is what you have rituals for too in those past societies. You have rituals for entering that state of existence, but also leaving it again. And whether they work, I don't know. but I think they did. I think that was the whole point, right? But it's also interesting. You can see there's like there's a case of a Viking as found in a grave. So this is the famous a case where they have identified his brother, I think it was a cousin, in England, and this guy died in Denmark. So he had a cousin or a family member in England, and they've done that by DNA stuff. And they were very obviously professional warriors and Vikings, right? Straight up the definition of Vikings. And the guy who died in Denmark, he died from a slash to his thigh. And it looks like he died several years after he had stopped being a professional warrior. So what does that tell you? It can perhaps tell us that this guy was an example of one of those PTSD Vikings, right? Who just couldn't leave the violence behind after having been to war and lived like a Viking for maybe decades, who knows, then comes back to his original community and settles again, or maybe, you know, a neighboring original community. And then, you know, he still winds up getting into trouble in different ways because he just couldn't leave it, right? So this, you know, of course, has something to do with mental disposition and psychology, right? Whether or not you are capable of doing that and re-entering society, or you keep these things with you. So, but they definitely had rituals to try to mitigate that. That's what humans have always done, right? Having rituals to change your life situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's it doesn't seem like it's so different to how it is now, you know. Because like I say, you have this idea of these quote unquote Vikings as being bloodthirsty warriors who just deal with it. Is that, again, going back to like that idea we were talking about earlier of this masculine kind of idea of you just deal with it. They go out, do what they gotta do, and deal with it. And a Viking having mental health issues, like, fuck, that's not a thing. Like, that's kind of this of how you see it. But they will have, you know, people aren't meant to chop each other up with fucking axes or saws, no matter how pretty it might look in a movie or on a film and glorified. At the end of the day, it's messy, it's ugly, it's not going to look nice, and it's going to stick with you for a long time.
That's really what we can see from some of those descriptions of the afterlife. You know, I can't remember what saga it is, but there's one of the legendary sagas. Fuck, why am I forgetting it? There's this situation where, I think it's a woman whose husband has been killed in war, and then she has like a dream or a situation where she sits and talks with him, and he's like described as like he's still in his armor and he's like icy and bloody, and he's just come out of like the death realm to talk to her, really, right? So like they knew and understood that the blood and gore aspect of it, and they added that to it because of course that's how it works, right? And so, yeah, no, it's definitely I think in many ways they probably managed to handle these problems that would come with war and all of that violence in a better way in pre-Christian Viking society. I can't really speak for post-conversion because that's a different story, at least further down the line, right? But yeah, there's something that to me at least indicates that, you know, bridging the transitions between states of mind with ritual always seems to have been a very helpful and positive way of handling it. Again, this is something that seemingly is missing today in so many contexts, right? And think about what we were just talking about with like being a young boy as opposed to being a man, and, you know, growing into being an adult man, all of that stuff. Like, there's not a lot of ritual today to help that transition either. And I think that's a problem. I think that's a serious problem, because what a ritual always tells you is that, well, now you have gone from A to B, right? And it's a defining marker in time for that transition, right? If you just like slowly go into manhood from boyhood, right? Then you might not notice, and you might not really understand what it means, right? Especially if you don't have any guides to help you, right?
There's no experience there.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing to help you build up that new character.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, are all Viking warriors screaming till Valhalla when they die? Is that a thing? Are they all just? Because that's the TV movie idea, which I think a lot of people probably believe as well, is that all warriors are the secret. It's almost as if they're wanting to die, but like they don't want to like give up and just die. But secretly, they want it to happen so they can go to Valhalla and drink beer and fight all the time. That's how it seems, or it's portrayed anyway.
So. I don't think so. I mean, like this in the saga literature, we don't have, you know, instances of like somebody screaming till Valhalla.
Do they ever say till Valhalla in any of the saga literature ever?
Can't really remember any example of that. What usually happens, right? If somebody, and this is especially in duels, right? So if somebody, is dying, is on the verge of dying, or has just been struck with the dying blow, all that stuff, they recite a poem. Sometimes a very long poem, and you're like, and like, again, going back to Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, right? When he kills Fafnir, he presumably stabs him, like, probably right in the heart or something like that. Blood gushes out everywhere. Like,
yeah, he's underneath him. And I mean, anybody who wants to listen to the story of Saga of the Volsungs, join us on our Patreon and you can hear us go through literally beginning to end of the saga. Jonas reads it out and narrates it, which is a lot of fun. But they say Sigurd is in a pit underneath Fafnir, and he kind of cuts him from underneath because he talks about the acid spraying down on him. So it's a wound.
Yes.
It's a scratch.
Yes, just put a scratch. Yes. The thing is that afterwards, like if we go to the Poetic Edda, where we have this entire story in poems, right? There's a whole poem that is just based around Fafnir, like reciting poetry after he has been killed, pretty much.
I remember when Jonas was reading it, I was like, that fucker won't shut up.
Exactly, just keep going and going. It's like, you're dead, man. What? It's like, what is his face? Was it Herman Cain, who was this Republican politician that was posting on Twitter after his death because some of his family members had the access to his account? So he was like, aren't you dead? Yeah. Anyway, so that's like what usually happens is reciting poetry instead of screaming till Valhalla. Okay. So I am not entirely sure what if there's any examples of literary examples. There probably is one or something like that somewhere.
So do you think there is that obsession with wanting to get to Valhalla in the way that it's portrayed in kind of modern culture?
No, not really. I think considering that it is in sort of like scattered evidence surrounding Snorri's version of it in other literature, and considering that it's not necessarily described as a positive place, and where, you know, there's more focus on blood and gore, you know, and I think it's probably more likely that they were very conscious of the consequences of going to war and going to battle and dying that bloody, gory, painful death that is involved in, you know, getting an axe chopped you know, riding your dick. Like, is what happened to that poor guy who's buried at Repton in England.
I mean, if you're in a battle and you're aiming for the dick, you're a special kind of evil. You're a shit person if you're purposefully aiming for dicks.
Well, so I mean, that's is seemingly what is the case in that burial mound, right at the Repton camp. So this was the Great Heathen Army in the mid 800s. That was, like, you know, trousing around England, and they built a camp. They basically used St. Winston's Church as their, you know, little castle or fortification. Then they built a fortified wall around it and everything. And then they also built a burial mound to a warlord who had been killed. And it kind of looks like he got stabbed in the dick. So yeah, you're a special kind of evil if you do that.
I mean, yeah, not the dick.
Well, so the reason that we assume this is that he's got a boar's tusk between his legs, so like it seems like they probably, like, you know, since it was gone, put a boar's tusk there instead so that he had something to go to the afterlife with. So that tells you another thing, you know, they tend to probably assume that you need to go to Valhalla with your dick too.
The bros were looking out for him.
That's what I was just thinking. I mean, that's a good friend.
Bros right there.
I mean, yeah, help me out before I go.
And also, as Shan is pointing out in the chat, stab them in the dick would be a much more intimidating war cry than Till Valhalla.
Yeah.
I agree.
That would, yeah, it would be. I'd run away from those. Because obviously we know that the Snorri is writing from a Christian perspective. So is it possible he's writing Valhalla in this glorified way as kind of a heavenly like?
Yes. Place? So one thing to keep in mind is that Snorri has a very, very sharp distinction between heaven and hell, which comes from his Christian background. And he's basically transposing that onto Nordic mythology. So that means, like, the nine worlds and, you know, hell as this dreary, boring place and all that stuff, and Valhalla as some kind of paradise. That's him riffing off of Christianity to represent pre-Christian religion in Scandinavia as, like, this weird backwards Christian warrior cult, because his whole purpose of talking about this is to represent pre-Christian religion in Scandinavia as a misunderstood Christianity. And that's also why there's so many people who are reading Snorri's stories, and it's like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense, because most of them, they come from a Christian background, and if nothing else, a culturally Christian background. So, you know, a lot of the things like Odin as an all-father and all that stuff, it fits perfectly into, you know, a contemporary modern Christian culture. It's definitely not how they've seen it, though. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an entirely different way of thinking about it, I'm sure, back then. And I think they probably saw it in the way that they would go to an afterlife that pretty much looked like the one that they came from. So if your life was spent at war, then you would go to a warrior's afterlife. But that's not a paradise. That's a shadow version of the life that you lived. Mm-hmm. If you're a farmer, you would go to a farmer's afterlife. And maybe they thought, you know, we can base this off of the fact that there are, you know, these place name clusters in Scandinavian countryside where you have, you know, a little abode dedicated to Freyr and a mountain dedicated to Odin and a lake dedicated to Thor and stuff like that. Maybe they thought that they would go live there where Thor lives in the landscape, where Odin lives in the landscape, and so on. We have the poem Grimnir's Sayings, which gives us this religious landscape where these different gods live in different houses or abodes or castles, whatever we want to call them, you know, in a idealized version of reality. And they probably thought that it was more likely that they would go to that than, you know, this, you know, up there paradise ruled by Allfather Odin. and also, I mean, that poem, Grimnismal, says that the half of the dead warriors go to Freya, whatever the hell that means. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no other concept for it than just like two lines that says, oh yeah, and Freya takes half of them.
That's it.
It's like, okay,
figure it out,
right? So it's a lot more cryptic than we would assume, right? From based off of what Snorri is saying, because Snorri is very clear and easy to understand, and that's also one of the draws to him, right? That's why people like him, and not all of that weird ass poetry where you're like, what the hell are they talking about? Because we have a lot of that, we just don't use it.
No, because it's people want something nice and in a box. Okay. I can't, to pull it back to the earlier conversation, I'm saying this goes into how my brain works, because all I can think about is there being a Viking warrior out there with a necklace of people's dicks that he's cut off. And I don't know why I cannot get that out of my head. You know how you sometimes see it with like ears or something? I think he was on The Walking Dead with ears, like trophies. And there was just some dude who was just notorious for cutting up dicks, and that was his little necklace. And I don't know why I can't get that out of my fucking head now. to wrap up, before we wrap up, the one question I really wanted to get to is that I see time and time again in the Facebook chats of people arguing over, can modern people go to Valhalla? And people who are pagan, who believe in this as a religion, can they go to Valhalla without being a warrior? In like that kind of traditional sense of being a soldier, being a fighter, and dying in battle. Because it seems to split people down the middle all the time. You see people jump in there saying, no, absolutely not. You have to die in battle. And unless you're going and actually fighting and dying in battle, then you're not that tough. And some people are saying, you know, like things with like mental health, you struggle and you battle with mental health. Does that make you like a warrior in a modern sense? Because things change. You know, people aren't out fighting the same way they were back then. So there's not many opportunities to die by the sword in some Till Valhalla glorious way. But does it? Do you think it changes in a modern context? That's my dying question that I wanted to know. And that, this is for both of you. I want to get your opinions on kind of like what you think.
I'm gonna let Andy go first.
Honestly, like when you brought this idea up to me, you know, a couple hours ago before we got on the podcast, and I even told you, it's like, I don't think about Valhalla. I just don't. Did it exist? Did it not exist? Maybe. It's not something I put a lot of thought into. To me, it's, you know, living a life full of value and purpose and living that life to the fullest. And whatever happens afterwards, if there is a Valhalla, I think that's your best bet of getting into it, is did you live a life that was glorious, that was triumphant? If you're going to get into Valhalla, if there is one, I think that's the best bet into getting there. It's just living an absolutely glorious existence. That's pretty much my take on it. And that's at least like how I live life and how I hope everyone does. And as far as is Valhalla a thing, and do you have to die a warrior's death to get into there? It's not something I ever think about. And also, Snorri, like, it sounds a lot like Kevin. And I remember 5 to 10 years ago, I was at a bar with a buddy and I was like, I don't really believe in Valhalla. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not, I don't know if there is or not. It's not something I'm really going to put a lot of thought into because of that reason. It sounds a lot like heaven, and it's just like a more Scandinavian approach to it, I guess.
That's almost verbatim what I would say. I mean, as somebody who's raised heathen and, you know, that's, I guess, my belief or whatever. I do not give a shit about where I go to when I die. Mm-hmm. What I care about is how I live. And what legacy I leave behind, right?
I think
that is entwined in like the old stories and stuff too. Like if you
absolutely
if you eliminate Valhalla, and you really pay attention to those, especially in like the Icelandic sagas and stuff, you see that in every single one. Mm-hmm. That was their purpose. That was their whole meaning of existence, was to just live an mm-hmm. absolutely glorious life. Mm-hmm. And everyone can obtain that.
You know, you get that in Havamal in stanzas, what is it, 76 and 77, right, where he says that the cattle die, kinsmen die, you'll die yourself, but the one thing that will never die is a good reputation if you have gotten it.
I mean, that was their priority. That was a priority.
Exactly. Yeah. Much more than, you know, what does the afterlife look like? That's like conversations for, you know, Christians, I guess. They're interested right. in that.
I can't remember who, this is one of the early episodes we're on. I can't remember who it was that said it. But it seems like having this idea of looking past life and into the afterlife and having people focus on what's going to happen then is just a means for control, whether it's Christianity or I can't remember who it was that said Valhalla was kind of like an idea of like Scandinavians looking towards Christianity and seeing that as a way to control people. And it was one of the early episodes, and I cannot remember who it was, but it makes sense, because if you get people to look past life and look at this thing after and say, when you die, if you behave a certain way now, then you are going to get this after. And if you get people to look on this, you're going to get them to behave in a way you want now. Because it's like, whether Valhalla exists or not, in a sense that we think, it's like, if you are all really good warriors and you do what you're meant to do and you fight really hard, then you get to go to this amazing place. And the same with Christianity. If you do what you behave, you don't sin, you do what we want you to do, then you get to go to this place after. And that's what it seems like to me. It's just a method of control. It's distraction of putting this amazing thing over there and saying, yeah, do what we want now and you're going to be rewarded over there. But we can't actually prove that exists, and you can't prove it doesn't exist. So, because that's a lot of the time, I think, as well. If you put that down in people's mind, it's like you could say to someone, don't do that, you'll get £1 million. And then you're like, no, fuck no, no way I'm going to get £1 million. But then you start thinking, but what if I do? Like, what if I do get that? Then you automatically put that down in your mind. You're like, okay, maybe, well, it's not that. Maybe I'll just do what they ask. And then if I get the £1 million, great. And if I don't, then, oh, well, I'd never had it in the first place. You justify it to yourself to fall in line. And that's what it's always felt like to me, is just this big control method. So mm-hmm. whatever happens, happens.
I think that's true in many, many ways, at least. I mean, there are many ways that you can come up with, you know, stories and ideas to control people, but the idea of an afterlife and the ideas of like going to an afterlife as some kind of reward has everything to do with just simply controlling how people act now, right? You know, there are some obvious flaws in those narratives, like, you know, the most obvious one is always like, well, why does this dickhead go to heaven if I don't? Or, and you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, perfect. Let's wrap this one up. We've been here a while. I mean, this we focused a lot on kind of men, I guess, at the start, but I think all these things apply to women nowadays as well. That kind of line between the two is certainly not it's blurred. It's not like it used to be. There isn't these set roles that everyone has to fall into, and that's all for the better. You know, there's so many more women that are involved in going to the gym, getting muscular. Sarah, my wife's one of them. You know, she's in ridiculous shape, and that's because she enjoys doing it and has the freedom to do that now. So like I say, all these things apply across the board. We probably fall into the habit of talking in the context of men because we are men, and that's what you naturally do. You talk about what you know. But certainly, well,
I don't want to make any assumptions about what it feels like to be a woman.
You right. know? It's not our place to speak for women because we're not women. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, but the like I said, there's just things that I think people can learn regardless. It's not just a case of this being just for
absolutely. Men.
Because
I mean, it would be kind of interesting to have a woman on to talk about these same issues for women, like, and mm-hmm. and hear hear how you can use Old Norse literature to, you know, live a glorious life as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, this topic, I think, is just so important for people to speak and just open up and be willing to talk and not worry about ridicule. So yeah, and let people know where they can find you, find what you're doing, follow the podcast.
So you can find me on Instagram at Andrew Cliff Lewis. You can follow Norse Fitness at Norse_fitness. You can visit our website, norsefitness.co, and you can find the podcast, The Norse Mentality, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff.
There we go. Mateus.
You can find me on Instagram. By my name, of course. But you should also, of course, always go support our podcast on Patreon, and so that you can get a bonus episode every week, where we either go through a Q&A session or a story time with Jonas Lorentzen, who is awesome at making different voices for the different characters. And we always get into some weird conversation about what the hell is that thing that's happening right there.
Yeah, and then we've got a Q&A to record after this. And boy, do I have a rant today. Woo. If you tune in, if you do anything, just pop up, like, spend the I think it's £4, $5, and you can get it, and you can listen to all the back catalog. But today is going to be worth hearing me rant. So just get it for that. Cancel it after that. I don't care. you can cancel after that, but it's going to be worth that. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating, positive review. And you can follow us, Nordic Mythology Podcast, across the board. And that's a wrap.